Morning, my name is John Davis. Today is Monday the 31st of March 2014 and I'm about to interview Mr. John Morley. John, would you please introduce yourself and tell me when and where you were born?
Good morning, John. Good morning. My name is John Morley. I am obviously pleased to have this brief discussion. I was born in Gerrards Cross, just outside London, and that was in 1939, November. The name I try and hide from my Christian names is Guy, because the day I was born was the 5th of November.
Interesting. What years did you work at Fielding and Platt, John?
1971, I think fairly early in 71. Through until late 75.
Okay, and what were you employed as?
I was personnel manager for the whole time I was there. For some bizarre reason, I appear to have majored on that as my forte in life. I've been personnel manager in all its various forms of industrial relations or human resource manager ever since.
How did you first come to hear about the, Fielding and Platt, John? Did you answer an advertisement? Did you know anyone who worked there or what?
No, I didn't know anybody who worked there. Not until I arrived, of course. I actually ended up by seeing an advertisement. I think that must have been when Geoffrey Morton was leaving and there was a vacancy for a personnel manager, several interviews, and was taken on by David Rowles. I think there was a stand-in that was sent down from Worcester before I actually started.
Okay, you mentioned David Rowles. He was one of the directors, of course. Was it just David Rowles who interviewed you, or was there anybody else that you remember?
I was interviewed, screened perhaps would be the best expression, by the personnel stand-in from Worcester, whose name I can't recall, but survived obviously that interview as a short list and was then seen by just David Rowles.
Okay. So you obviously got the job and you eventually started. What path did your journey to the factory take? Did you travel past other factories, railway shops, etc. that you can, anything interesting you can tell me about?
Well, not particularly interesting. I had to come either round Gloucester or through it, because I lived not far from Churchtown at the time I was working at Fielding and Platt. And it was a tortuous run to go through Gloucester at busy times even then. But it was, I suppose, the easiest way to just go straight down Southcote Street and then turn into Atlas Works.
Okay. Right, on entering the factory for the first day then, what were your memories of the sights and the smells and the noise, etc.? Or had you worked in a similar environment before?
Well, I'd come from engineering, which I think has been in my blood forever, but migrated to office-type work quite quickly. But I'd come from aircraft, mostly, because I'd worked for Rolls-Royce and Bristol-Siddeley. And Doughty's was the place I left to join Fielding and Platt. And I liked heavy engineering as a concept because I've always been keen on steam engines. I even built a couple with my father, me acting very much as the apprentice, but we used to have them running round the garden at home, at my family home. So I was very familiar with the heavy noise of engineering. Whether you're doing turbine blades or large castings being machined, it was similar environment, although a lot more swarth was evident when I entered. And I think that's probably the thing I realised most when you looked, having walked round the factory, at the under part of your shoes. The one thing that was always there was swarth.
Wonderful. So you must have settled in quite quickly then, John, having had that background. Can you give me an idea now of the duties of a personnel manager in a company such as Fielding and Platt? And did you travel at all in, away from the factory?
Occasionally, there were needs to travel when we were looking for particular types of labour. I twice went up to the northeast because they were not having a very good time even then. And people like fabrication foremen and things like that, we found difficult to find local recruit. So often I went up there for that, and people who weren't afraid to put a few thou on a milling or other forms of machinery we had on a sort of 3 foot diameter casting, because that took a bit of bravado and you needed a particular sort of person who was used to doing that sort of thing. So I did travel that way, and we went down to Bristol quite a bit with the engineering employers, either for meetings on industrial problems or because we were part of the Federation and Jim Fielding was keen to make sure we took part in all the activities.
How about the day-to-day running within the factory then, John? You've mentioned outside. How about within the factory itself?
I always made sure I walked round the factory quite a lot, hence the swarf, I suppose. But the role very often meant that you were there at meetings and trapped in the office somewhat. But at some stage in the day, you need to know the people and make sure that you're seen by those on the shop floor particularly. And not to forget the drawing offices and accounts, you know, you showed your face. But you were responsible really for the whole of the workforce. You reported directly to the managing director. You weren't sort of a second tier, as it were, of management. You were in the senior management area. And you wanted to make sure you were around and being seen as being approachable.
Okay, thank you for that. Can you tell me a little bit about the people you worked with, like fellow members of management, say, and your secretary, any particular members of the workforce you can recall?
Yes, I recall being lucky enough to get hold of my secretary. I think there must have been a change fairly early on when I got there, that one secretary left and I was then looking for another one. And I persuaded a young lady who was coming down because of her husband's job from Leamington Spa, I think it was. And she, Jan Langley was her name, and she actually was, from my point of view, a breath of fresh air, because she took over a lot of the administration role of personnel and record keeping and was very accurate and very keen to do the same sort of job as I was doing, but doing the detailed work, which I think through my career I've not been famous for.
I think a lot of us can say that, John. How about remember about members of the management? I mean, you mentioned David Rose, I think. Is there anybody else particularly that you can remember?
Well, yes, over the years, certainly, although there weren't many, they were fairly formative years in my background. I remember people like Frank Bullock. Ron Wilmot was the training manager, and we had the two foremen, who Marcus Jelfs and Barry Degg, I think, were their names, that looked after the first-year apprentices. Bert Rogers was one of the works managers. Jack Baker, the finance director, who I spent a lot of time with, because over that 4 or 5 year period, we did need to make a number of changes to the company, which required a lot of intervention with finance and people, with the inevitable consequences, regrettably. chap called Whitmore was the buying office manager,
Bob,
I think.
Bob Whitmore,
that was it. An Esmond Sargent, I remember him, the drawing office manager. All lots of names. Garfield, James, Ron Green, Jack Hobbs, lots of people. The names sort of flit in and out of the memory. It's all a little while back now. But they were all characters, I think, as one could see why it is the company held such a high regard amongst not only its staff, but respect in the district.
Thank you, John. Obviously, someone in a position like you has to be discreet. But can you recall any interesting events or any amusing events without embarrassing anybody?
I'm not sure too many can be related that don't cause embarrassment to somebody. I clearly spent a long time discussing various problems with the unions. Gilbert Vallander and Mr. Kelly was the electrical union representative, I remember. And we used to have quite heated discussions many times about all sorts of things. There were lots of incidents during that time, and there was the winter of discontent, which many people of my generation will remember. We went on to three-day weeks and had most inventive ways of trying to maximise the output by rotating people's duty over 3 days in trying to keep production up, which we did pretty successfully. And at one stage, Gilbert Vallander was known to mention that we actually appeared to be getting more out of people over 3 days than we were out of the normal five, so why didn't we operate a three-day system every week? He did come up with a number of ideas of that sort, not many of which we could follow. The Engineering Training Board was very important in those days, and we did have a craft school that was particularly important. We used to get well over 100% rebate back from the Engineering Training Board. And actually, on more than one occasion, the return of 110 or 15% was actually quite important to Fielding and Platt's finances. There was one occasion when I remember being sent to Bristol to actually fetch the cheque. We felt it was necessary to bolster Fielding and Platt's account and not wait. Things were, on occasions, very tight. We had funny examples of things. One time when Jim Fielding was visiting, he actually almost fired someone else's delivery driver because he thought they were wasting company time. And it might have been company time, but it wasn't our company time he was wasting. We got over that. There was also an incident of a bomb hoax, which requires a little relaying. Earlier in the day, someone had said, "Have you seen that bloke, big, tall Irish chap, looking for you? He's been wandering around the company for a bit." And as you know, the company was open to the back and people could come and go quite easily. A little while later, someone said, "There's a strange package underneath the car in the car park in the new build shop on the far side of the road." And you then join these two things together, so you think it's a good idea to phone the police. And this equally large policeman comes along and looks at the package and decides it's worth an investigation to find that it was a load of spanners or things that people had put under their car. A visiting workman, one hopes, rather than borrowed stock from the company. During the said power cuts, Mrs. Jones, we'll talk of her perhaps a little later, celebrated Mrs. Jones, who was Estonian by birth, but was a very formidable lady, used to bake bread and sell it to the workforce because the power was going to go down, and she tried to make the best of the power that we had to be useful. And then there was the postal strike. when I had to step up and be Postmaster General. And everyone who was travelling anywhere in the country had to tell me that they were going to X, Y or Z, and I could give them any post that was relevant. And we then spent a lot of money when people were flying abroad on stamps to actually send post abroad by having to buy stamps to whichever country they were going to. But we managed. There were sort of things like there was a famous trolley that used to trundle round, not the one that dispensed tea, which was absolutely fantastic, round the shop floor. And if you were lucky, there was the odd bacon bap or something like that on it. But there was one that I'm not quite sure what the purpose of it was, but it's displayed on one side a sign that said, buy me and stop one. And on the other side, it said, stop me and buy one. The implication's obvious, but it used to cause a lot of mirth to visitors when they came round the factory. There was an incident which caused a bit of a calamity. Monty Blunt, the maintenance manager, I think, decided that one of the ways to clear the drains, which we had a bit of a problem with, was to actually put a fairly powerful air hose down to give it a bit of a blast to make sure that any matter was then cleared through the drains. Whether it was the type of blockage or the amount of power, difficult to say, but the result was a couple of manhole covers came off, and it took quite a few pounds to clean people's cars that were nearby. These little things did happen. But those are the sort of stories that one can relate.
Wonderful, John. Absolutely wonderful. Thanks very much for that. Anyway, I think we've... my next question is about the trade unions. I think you've already mentioned them. Okay, let's go on to the lighter side. did you use the canteen facilities at all? And if so, what do you think of them?
They were fabulous. The celebrated Mrs. Jones, from memory, was pinched from a company that used to do catering at the Farnborough Air Show. And Jim Fielding actually spotted her and thought, we need someone like this to look after our canteens. And we did actually have quite a few different dining rooms, which over the course of time I had to modify a little, because it was very expensive to cater for all of those different dining rooms. But we had a very high ratio of people eating in our canteen. The average, particularly if you think of we were near the town centre, was for people to go shopping and have a sandwich on the way sort of thing. But we actually had a very high ratio of employees eating in the canteen, and we're very proud, Mrs. Jones particularly very proud of all the rather unusual foods that her background perhaps and her catering ability could cope with. And I remember very favourite soup of mine was borscht soup, the Russian borscht soup, and it was a sought after commodity. It was excellent food, and I think we were very well served by a very notable character.
That's lovely, lady.